Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to week two of the series. So we've started a series called The Strong Mind, based on the 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do by Amy Morin. It's just a book I was reading through. So I want to just start, first of all, by a little introduction, a little review that we normally do, and then we'll go to today's one. So we started off last week by explaining that even when you engage in good mindsets and good things, but if there's things that are blocking us and standing in the way, we need to remove those thought mindsets that stand in the way of that process, which we connected to the idea when the Jews went out of Egypt, they had to go out of Egypt first, and there was three expressions of them leaving Egypt before we have that expression of them engaging with what they had to become. We explained that the author was very in line with Jewish thinking and that she wanted to propose that we attack and we deal with changing our mindsets and our actions, because emotions are hard to change. We can guide them, but if you deal with it by changing the way we think, framing, reframing, and reinterpreting the way we think about things, and then engaging in good behaviors and good practices, that really helps in terms of developing strength of the mind and inner happiness and so on. So we did the first chapter last week, which was strong-minded, mentally strong people don't waste time feeling sorry for themselves. And we discussed just very briefly the trap that we all fall into from time to time, which is the self-pity party, which delays confronting the important issues, but really becomes very destructive. So we talked about the mindsets that we have to have, and but also talked about the action of volunteering, doing something positive, reframing the way we think about our situation. And at the end, we talked about replacing the self-pity with gratitude and keeping a gratitude journal and so on and so forth. So today I want to, if there's time, hopefully, actually cover two chapters. The second chapter we'll do briefly because it's something we've talked about a lot, but let's do a chapter two first. And chapter two is headed that mentally strong people, they don't give away their power. Now, we'll see what that means exactly in a moment, but the topic is an important one because it actually goes, first of all, goes to the core of the ability that we have to choose our responses and to choose our behavior. That choice thing that we talked about a lot really is very much connected with this concept of not giving away our power. The second thing is that this chapter and this discussion is going to hopefully give some clarity with regards to what is considered strong and what is considered a weakness. In other words, what's a strength and what's a weakness, which is something which is often confused. And also, it connects, thirdly, it connects to many challenging but tempting negative emotions like resentment, revenge, anger, frustration, and topics like responding to criticism, the ability to forgive, and so on. This concept that we choose to allow these things to control us or not to control us is reflected in a little Hasidic story. The Hasidic story takes place with the Maggid of Mezrich, famous Maggid of Mezrich, who had many great disciples. And one of the disciples once asked him, he said, you know, you talk about controlling your thoughts and not having negative thinking patterns, but is that really possible? I mean, thoughts come into our minds all the time. Can we really control what we think? Can we control those mindsets? Can we control those messages that we have in the brain? See, he didn't answer him, but he told him, because he was about to take a trip, and he said, you know, on your way, I want you to stop into one of my disciples, who was then also a very great Hasidic Rebbe in his own right. Just stop in to him and give him my regards. So he did, and he left for the trip, and he arrived in the town, and it was winter, and it was late at night, and he knocked on the door, and he knew that someone was home, the light was on, and there was a candle burning, and there was activity, and he knocked and knocked, and the guy didn't let him in, and it was a little cold, and it was a little hard, and he just doesn't understand. Tries again in a few minutes, and still this repeated itself many, many times. Eventually, after, I don't know, an hour, 2 hours, the guy actually lets him in, welcomes him, no, so nice to see you. what's happening at the Rebbe's court and so on. And eventually he says, why, you know, what's the mission? What's the purpose of your visit? He tells him he was asked to give regards, but he told him that I'd asked the Magid of Mizrich this question. The Magid had chosen not to answer, but instead he sent me on my way home. He sent me to you, and he said I should stop at your house. And I'm not sure why. So the tzaddik said to him, it's very simple, which would explain why he didn't let him in. He said, the Magid of Mizrich sent you to me for you to learn that when someone owns a house, he lets in who he chooses to, and he doesn't let in who he doesn't choose to. Which was the way of saying, it's your brain, it's your head. You choose what you let in and where you choose what you don't let in. Now, of course, one needs to clarify that. We don't always control the initial thoughts that come into our head, because often initial thoughts that come into our brains and our heads are fueled by instinctive emotions which we actually cannot control. Things like initial judgmental messages or initial feelings of anger and so on and so forth. But we certainly choose if we keep it there or if we don't keep it there in many, many different ways. So it's very much connected with the discussion that we're going to have. So this chapter entitled that those people with a strong mind don't give away their power. In the book that I'm basing this on, it starts off this chapter with a story. First of all, it starts off with a quote from Dale Carnegie, who actually I'm not a tremendous fan of, but anyways, he says, when we hate our enemies, we are giving them power over us, power over our sleep, our appetites, our blood pressure, our health, and our happiness. Anyway, it's a good quote. He's completely right. But let's go to the story that she begins with, because the story that she tells about a client of hers that came for therapy is a good way to go into this topic, and we can break it down and understand the various components of this discussion. Now, it starts off with a woman who she calls Lauren, who had a very overbearing and meddling mother-in-law. Now, I just want to clarify the purpose of me quoting the story. It's a story in the book. I'm certainly not having a go at any mothers-in-law. Mother-in-law jokes aside, mothers-in-law are great people. Always had a great relationship with my mother-in-law. Although I have to say she lives in New Jersey and I live here, so that maybe explains it, I don't know, but she's a great person. So I'm certainly not having a go at mothers-in-law. But this is the story. So the story goes, I'll read you part of it and I'll tell you part of it and we'll break it down. The story goes that Lauren was convinced her overbearing, meddling mother-in-law was going to ruin her marriage, if not her entire life. Although she had thought her mother-in-law, Jackie, was annoying in the past, it wasn't until she and her husband had two children together that she found her to be completely unbearable. So what's the story? Jackie would usually make several unannounced visits each week, and she often stayed for several hours at a time. But what really bothered her was the way she always tried to undermine her authority with the two girls. Jackie would often say things to the children like, you know, a little TV won't hurt you. I don't know why your mother always says you can't watch it. Or I'd let you have some dessert, but your mother's convinced that sugar is bad for your health, and so on. So it says the story that Lauren always responded to Jackie's comments with a polite nod and a smile, but on the inside, she was seething. She grew resentful towards Jackie, and she often took it out on her husband, which often happens. But whenever Lauren complained to her husband about his mother, he'd say something like, well, you know how she is, just ignore her comments. A very man response. She means well. Lauren found comfort in complaining to her girlfriends, who had affectionately named Jackie the monster-in-law. But one week, everything seemed... I'm reading this, it's a bit of a long story. I'm reading it because it's a really good framework to unpack this whole concept. But one week, everything seemed to come to a head when Jackie suggested Lauren should start exercising more because she looked like she had gained a little weight. That comment pushed Lauren over the edge. She stormed out of the house and spent the night at her sister's. The next day, she didn't come home yet, and it took a while anyway. Lauren initially sought counseling to learn anger management skills to help her respond less angrily to her mother-in-law's comments. However, after a few therapy sessions, she was able to see that she needed to work on being more proactive in preventing problems, not just less reactive to Jackie's comments. That's a very important thing. In other words, she had to know how to respond, and oh, not just about learning how not to respond, which are both very important skills. So she says, I asked Lauren to complete a pie chart that showed how much time and energy she focused on various aspects of her life. When she was done with the second pie chart, she was surprised to see how much her time and energy were out of proportion. Although she only physically spent about 5 hours a week with her mother-in-law, she was devoting at least an additional 5 hours thinking and talking about her disdain for her. The exercise helped her see how she was giving her mother-in-law power over many areas of her life. When she could have devoted her energy to nurturing her relationship with her husband and caring for her children, she was often thinking about how much she disliked Jackie. So the story goes on that once she realized how much power she was giving Jackie, she chose to start making some changes. So she worked with her husband on setting healthy boundaries for the family. They told Jackie that she could no longer make unannounced visits. They also informed her that she could no longer undermine Lauren's authority as a mother, and if she did, she might be asked to leave. Slowly but surely, Lauren began to feel that she was getting her life and her home back. She no longer dreaded Jackie's visits once she recognized that she didn't have to tolerate rude or disrespectful behavior in her home. Instead, she controlled what went on under her roof. So that's the story. Now, first of all, this idea of when we upset with people and we continuously obsess and think about what people have done to us or said to us or how much they're interfering and blocking and standing in the way of our happy and healthy lifestyle, it's a great way to think about it before we even start about it's actually us giving them power. It's us letting them into our head. As you heard me say many times, Rabbi Dr. Twersky, we're giving them lodging in our head rent-free, right? Not only are we letting them stay there rent-free, we're actually giving them power. We're giving them power to ruin our life. And at the end of the day, fundamental principle number one is whether they're going to ruin our lives or not actually depends on us, if we're going to let them or not. Now, it's not so simple. It's easier said than done. What does that all mean? And that's what we need to kind of break down. So I want to break this down in the following way. First of all, the first thing to understand like this. Sometimes when we respond unhealthily, in an unhealthy way to people around us, right, giving them that power, it actually comes very often from seemingly a very good place. In other words, it comes from a good place, but it's very misapplied, right? So let me give you an example from the story, which the author of the book actually points out. She says that Lauren was very clear to herself that she really wanted to be a nice person, right? And she wanted to be a good wife. And she thought what that meant was, so that's the foundation. All those things are true. We should be nice people. We should be good spouses and partners and so on, right? But she thought what that meant was tolerating her interfering mother-in-law at all costs, right? Because she felt it would be disrespectful to ask her not to come, or she was hesitant to speak up when she felt hurt because she didn't want to offend her. She wanted to be respectful. And all those things are really important. That's true. We're going to talk about, right? She'd been raised to turn the other cheek and so on. But what she saw that without taking the power, right, and without setting the proper boundaries, it was actually not going to work. And she wasn't actually going to end up being that respectful and nice person that she so wanted to be. Because anytime you don't set healthy emotional and physical boundaries for yourself, you risk giving away your power to other people, which can be ineffective and destructive. So what does all that mean? So let's break that down even further. So where it was coming from is true. In other words, it was coming from a space that she wanted to be respectful to her mother-in-law. Now, in that story, that is a good space to come from. Respect for people who are older than us, respect for people in general, and respect for parents-in-law, specifically from a Jewish point of view, is actually really important. Now, I say that because actually if you look in Shulchan Aruch, if you look in the Code of Jewish Law, in the laws and the Talmudic literature on respecting parents, which is one of the Ten Commandments, one of the fundamental principles in Jewish experience, you will find that as an extension, the rabbis explained to us that as an extension, we actually have to respect, with all the laws of respect that it comes with, respect parents-in-law. So much so, I'll tell you an interesting thing, and I'm not judging anyone for their practices and their habits. But just to point it out, it's a very interesting thing. There are many, many people who are careful with these sort of halachic details that actually will not call parents-in-law by their first name, even though that's the standard in society. And it's possible that halachically, if it's a standard in society and they don't mind, it could be halachically acceptable. But I'm just bringing it as an example that many, many people, I know in our community, we do that. We do not call parents-in-law by their first name because, like, we don't call parents by their first name because it's part of respect, right? So I'm just bringing out that the place where she was coming from, her basis for getting into this mess in the first place was a principle, a value, a moral attitude, Jewishly sound, ethically sound, to be a nice person, to be a tolerant person, and to go out of their way to go the extra mile to be respectful to a mother-in-law. All good things. However, like all good things, all good things need to come from a place of self-control and not from a place of being controlled by others. Let me say that again. In other words, all values that we live by are only really effective. They remain good values no matter how you apply them. But all good values that we apply have to come or should come from a place of us controlling ourselves to live in a moral and ethical way, rather than coming from the control that other people have over us. It might come from the inspiration people give us, but not if it comes from the control that people have over us, it doesn't work. By the way, this is a very fundamental principle in parenting. Parents' job, parents' brief, is to instill values into their children. Very often what parents do is they enforce values at home, make sure that their children are very, very compliant to all the values, with very young children, that's a good thing as a start, that you ask children to behave in a particular way, just like you would physically. For example, you don't inspire children not to cross the road when there's a car coming, you tell them not to. So for someone who a Jewish experience, Jewish behavior is very important, or any other value is very important, it's the same thing. However, some parents, what they do is they just keep on enforcing compliance and never really inspire those values, and then wonder later on in life why children turn against those values. Because values which are enforced on you and controlled don't really work. So therefore, together with teaching values to children, for example, or even expecting compliance at a very young age, the job of a parent is to inspire those values, to explain those values when the child gets older, and to create a culture where those values are absorbed and internalized willingly. But going back to the point, so values that we live by need to come from self-control. We need to be able to control ourselves. We need to choose to go by those values, right? But not by being controlled by other people. Because if it comes from control, it's coming from others, it's coming from a weakness, not from a strength. And then what happens is a couple of things. When we behave in certain ways, which are based on good things, but we behave that way because we're being forced or controlled by other people, that means that we are behaving that way out of a weakness that affects a whole bunch of things. Firstly, it affects other things, other values. You see, this is an interesting problem that people experience. So we have a range of values in our life, right? For example, we have a range of values that even to do with our relationships, which often take up a lot of time and they start conflicting with each other, and sometimes it's hard to balance or juggle. Conflicting priorities. For example, even in the story, a person wants to be a good daughter-in-law as she wanted to be. A good daughter to her own parents. A good spouse. Shalom bayit. What can be better than shalom bayit? Shalom bayit, peace in the home, is an amazing value. But also being a good mother is a good value. And then being a good person to friends, to people, to society in general. Now, to implement all those values, as everyone would know, is sometimes difficult because to have a lot of values is not hard. But to implement them, to behave according to them, to spend time on them, which often they take time, is difficult. And we need to be able to prioritize, we need to be able to juggle, right? The only way we can juggle different priorities is if we live our values from a point of strength. It's because we believe it's the right thing to do. We believe that that's the moral and ethical way to behave and to live. Not because someone else wants me to do it, but because I choose to do it. Now, we'll see what that means in a moment. But So therefore, if I choose to do it, I want to do it the right way, and I want to do it how it's right. Now, when things start to conflict with each other, so being a good son-in-law or daughter-in-law then conflicts with being a good husband or a good father or a good whatever, then I need to find out. I need to explore what's the right thing to do. The right thing to do might be thinking about it, might be talking to a spiritual coach, it might be reading literature on it to understand how to balance the various priorities so that I can implement my willingness to live by a good value in the correct and moral way. But if it comes, and then I can juggle, and then I learn to juggle, because juggling doesn't mean I do whatever's good for someone else. I do what is the right thing to do, right? Without interference from who's the strongest person. You see, if I'm living by my values because other people want me to live, so my spouse wants me to be a good husband, my mother-in-law wants me to be a good son-in-law, my father wants me to be a good son, whatever the case is, then how do I juggle my priorities? I juggle by the strongest influencer, by the strongest one that's going to pull me. But if I'm living my values from within, because I choose to do that, because I believe in them, I believe they're the right thing to do, then I implement them and juggle them and balance them, not based on who is stronger, who's pulling me the strongest in their direction, but I implement them based on what is the most right way to behave. I hope that's making sense. Therefore, what happens is that when we live our values from weakness, as she was doing, by being controlled by other people, right, we actually end up harming the other areas of responsibility and value-based living. So in that case, for example, she was becoming a bad mother, a bad wife, not spending good time with her family because she became so occupied by being so upset and feeling so undervalued and disrespected by the one value relationship that we have, and ending up harming and potentially destroying some of the other relationships. Now, I must just pause here for a second. When I said that we have to live our values based on because we choose to and we believe in them, so I just have to pause and, of course, give a disclaimer to that or clarify, so not disclaimer, a clarification, which I do many, many times, but I'm very passionate about this because society has really so distorted this concept, right? When I say that we have to live by the values because we choose to do them, I don't mean the modern society application of doing something from a strength, meaning an egocentric strength. I don't mean that at all. Where people have become overly focused on self-preservation, right? I think that's very true. You have people like in this story, but you also have people who have taken the reins and I'm going to live strongly and I'm going to make my own choices, be my own person. And actually what ends up happening is you undermine all your values because you become so absorbed and obsessed and immersed in self-preservation. It's a very bad thing. And we have to be very, very aware of that. Or only doing things that we believe in, meaning believing that we feel comfortable with, that is rational to us, that we understand. I don't mean that at all. Because I come from a Jewish perspective, and in a Jewish perspective, as it's explained so many different places and so many different sources of literature, of Jewish literature and mysticism and Kabbalah and Hasidut and so on and so forth, selflessness is a very admired value in Judaism. Not only selflessness admired, but the concept of bitul. Bitul means, it's hard to translate the word bitul, but bitul means almost self-nullification, self-negation, negating the ego, right? Where we surrender to a higher cause, to a higher being. So no, I don't mean that strength means that I choose to only do things that I believe in because I understand them or they relate to me or they're good for my comfort level. No. It is the only way to be a true human being, to be a value-based human being, is to actually surrender and to not box ourselves into only doing things that fit with us, but rather to be, yes, controlled, but not controlled by other people, inspired by other people, but to be controlled by God. To be in God's hands is okay. To be in a higher being's hands is fine. And to surrender to his understanding and his infinity, and to understand that if I want to grow as a human being and I want to go beyond myself, I need to sometimes do things I don't want to do, or to do things that I don't feel comfortable with, or my egocentric, animalistic part of me doesn't get pleasure from, right? So that's very, very important. So I think just important to clarify. In fact, while we're clarifying this, I'm going to share with you a very beautiful idea. Because I'm always very afraid about this trap. And I'm afraid of it because I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen with certain people who are so into personal growth that they actually become more into personal without the growth. So it becomes very much self-focused and self-absorbed, and they leave little room for other people because they're so busy growing themselves. In other words, they're growing. What are they growing? They're growing themselves rather than growing properly, right? You know, there's a wonderful little Mishnah, a wonderful passage in Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot is the ethics of the fathers, of course. And there's a part, a little passage there that talks about, I'm going to read it to you and share it with you and just tell you a nice little idea that I once heard. And it talks about Arba Midot Ba'adam, that there's four personalities when it comes to giving to other people and sharing with other people and so on and so forth. And the highest one, which the Pirkei Avot calls the Hasid, the pious one, the one that goes beyond the call of duty and so on, says that someone who says, Sheli shelach v'shelach shelach, what is mine is actually yours. In other words, I'm selfless, I'm ready to share and give. And what is yours, I don't need it, I don't need you to give me back. That's a pious person, right? On the other hand, someone who says, Sheli shelach, what is mine is yours, v'shelach sheli, and what is yours is mine. That's just a very simple, ignorant way of behaving. Now, let me just explain that before I go on. Because I think what the Pirkei Avot is telling us is that often people are giving people and nice people and very fine people, but they always need it to be reciprocal, right? And the Mishnah is telling us that that's a very simple way of living. Not selflessness calls. It doesn't always have to be reciprocal. Not that you should be a shmata, not that you should be a doormat, not that you should allow yourself to be harmed by other people. Of course we need to protect ourselves and we need to be respected and so on. But just because I'm very hospitable or very kind to other people doesn't mean I need to expect them all to be kind to me, because I need to be kind because it's the right thing to do and it's the ethical thing to do and it's the right way to live, ultimately bringing the right happiness. So, okay, so therefore the pious person is one who says, what is mine is yours, I'm ready to share, and what is yours is mine, what is yours belongs to you. I don't want it to be reciprocal. That's very pious. If someone says, what is mine is yours, but what is yours is mine, that's very simple. Now, of course, someone who says, what is yours is mine, and what is mine, that's just a narcissist, and that's, of course, a wicked person. But then there's one very interesting one, where the Pirkei Avot says, if someone says, sheli sheli v'shalach shalach, what is mine, what is yours, so there's two responses to that in the Mishnah. One says, Zo mida benonit. That's an average way of living. And then the passage continues, Ve'yesh omrim, and some say, Zu midat zdom. That's a living like people who were in Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, Sodom and Gomorrah were two cities in the time of Avraham Avinu, which were wicked cities, cruel people, people who never shared. There was no hospitality in the city of Sodom. There was no giving. There was a mandate, a law against being hospitable and so on and so forth. Very evil person. So it's a very strange thing. Again, let me just say the passage to you. The Mishnah tells us that if someone says, what is mine, what is yours, that's an average way of living. And it says, V'yesh omrim, and some people say, or those that say, that actually, no, it's a Sodomite way of living. That's quite opposite. How does it become from an average way of living to a Sodomite way of living? So someone once explained to me a beautiful thought. What the Mishnah is saying is following. If someone lives in a way, what belongs to me is mine, what's mine is mine, what yours is yours, that's an average way of living. What does that mean? It means that if we do this once in a while, we're normal people. Not everyone could be a pious person that is always sharing and always giving and never wants anything back. That's hard. That is hard. So, you know, average way of living is, I'm an honest person. Maybe I'm not an overly giving person. Maybe I'm not a philanthropist. Maybe I'm not a generous person, but I don't do anything wrong. I never steal. I don't take away what belongs to others. I don't want people to take from me. I don't give particularly. I don't want anything from anyone else. I live my own life in my own bubble. It's pretty average. And the truth is that a lot of us do live that way some of the time. And then the Mishnah continues and says, but v'yesh omrim, but those who say, meaning those that some say, what the Mishnah is saying is that if you continuously say that's what it means v'yesh omrim. if it's not just once in a while you live like that, but becomes your philosophy, it becomes your way you operate, it becomes your perspective on life, that what is mine is mine and what is yours, that's a sodomite way of living. It becomes evil because you become self-absorbed. In other words, if you're not a pious person, if you don't live constantly with complete generosity and sharing and selflessness and giving, okay, so you're not a pious person. But so therefore you're just an average person. But if that becomes your way of operation, if that becomes your whole philosophy, the Yesh Omrim, that's what the Mishnah means to say, not just another opinion. The Yesh Omrim, those that say, which means those that continuously preach this as a philosophy of life, you become a sodomite. That's what happens. Why? Because part of life, fundamental to life, is growing. Growing requires negation of ego. Growing requires selflessness, right? So therefore, let's come back to what I was saying before. When I said that when we live by our values, we cannot live by way that others control us. We have to live because we choose to live by values. That doesn't mean self-preservation. That doesn't mean an egocentric way. That doesn't mean we have to relate to everything. We have to be comfortable with everything. It means we have to choose to be humble. We have to choose to be selfless. We have to choose sometimes to ignore criticism. We have to choose sometimes, and maybe it's okay. Not every time someone looks at us the wrong way, it's a problem. We have to be able to ignore that too, but from a choice, from a strength. These are good values, but we have to try and live by them because we believe in them. Believe in them doesn't mean we understand them or we enjoy them necessarily, because life isn't about enjoying things. It's about living a moral life, a value-based life. Some of those value-based values that we have are very hard, and we don't enjoy them, but we know it's good for us, because it's good for us to grow, it's good for us to submit, it's good for us to surrender, and it's good for us to be selfless. So in other words, when we talk about living our values from a strength, what it means is living them with strength, from a strength, but with humility, not with ego. Okay. Now, as we said before, if we live them from a weakness, we end up undermining other values, like she did in the story. So she was trying to be the best daughter-in-law, completely became obsessed with it, was thinking about it all the time, and she was not able to give the attention to others. More than that, we need to understand is that if we live a value from a weakness, what ends up happening is we undermine that same value as well. Like in that story, not only was she undermining her other priorities, not only was she stopping to be a good wife and a good mother and a good person, but at the end of the day, she was going to explode and not be a good daughter-in-law either. Because the value that she came from, which is respect for her mother-in-law, or being a nice person, or not responding to every criticism that we get, are all good values. But because they were coming out of control of someone else, the end game was going to be even not living by that value. Forget about undermining other values. She was going to end up being very disrespectful to her mother-in-law. She was going to end up being not a tolerant person. She was going to undermine those very values that she was coming to live by. So the point there is very clear. The point is, it's about taking power to choose to live by our values and not power to be trapped in ourselves. In other words, to do with humility, but taking the power to choose our values and to live by them from a strength. Now, this concept of living our values and not being controlled by others, in other words, taking back the power to ourselves, not giving the power to other people over ourselves, relates to so many different things. I'll just read you a couple of things she mentions in the chapter because, you know, you might be able to relate to some of them, all of them, or a good part of them, etc., right? So she says that giving other people the power to control how you think, feel, and behave makes it impossible to be mentally strong. Like, do these points sound familiar? And I'll read some of them. You feel deeply offended by any criticism or negative feedback you receive, regardless of the source. A lot of us are like that, right? All it means is we give tremendous power to other people. Other people have the ability to make you feel so angry that you say and do things you later regret. Well, some of us do that, right? You've changed your goals based on what other people have told you, right? Goal changing. Because we let other people control us, all of a sudden our goals become different. The type of day you're going to have depends on how other people behave. When other people try guilt you into doing something, you reluctantly do it, even if you don't want to. Right? You work to ensure other people see you in a positive light because your self-worth depends on other people. You spend a lot of time complaining about people and circumstances you don't like, right? You go to great lengths to feel to avoid feeling uncomfortable or having uncomfortable emotions, embarrassment or sadness. You don't know how to set boundaries. You hold a grudge or when someone offends or hurts you, and so on and so on and so on. It continues. So this is what happens when we lose our own power over ourselves and we give it to other people. Now the problems that come when we give away our power is exactly this, right? We depend on others to regulate our feelings. You see, as we said in the very beginning, it's very hard to change our own emotions, but we can guide them. We can have control where we put them through our mindset and through our behavior and through channeling them the right way. But we can only do that if we take back the power, if we choose to do that, not if we give back our whole identity to other people to have power over us. And not if we let other people define our self-worth. Not if we give power to other people, and then what happens is we become a victim of circumstances. We become a victim of everything that happens to us because we don't have any power of ourselves. And then what happens is we become so incredibly sensitive to criticism from others because they've got so much power over us, which is a huge problem. Because criticism, as we've talked about many times, is a good thing. It's not always given in the right way, and it's not always true, and it's up to us to decide if it's true or not. But actually, criticism is a really good thing. We grow from criticism. There's a mitzvah in the Torah to give criticism when people are doing the wrong thing, if the circumstance is right, if the setting is right, if the context is right, and if it's given in the right way. But nevertheless, criticism is not intrinsically a bad thing. Right. And also, we know how important it is to live a value-based life. One of the important things is to be able to set healthy goals. We can never set healthy goals if we don't take back the power of how we choose to live our day. Of how we choose, again, not selfishly, but how we choose to implement our values, how we choose to balance our values, how we choose to express our values. So what do we do about it? So step one, of course, is to take back, to reclaim our power. But as we said before, to reclaim our power, but not to undermine our own values, of course. In other words, to reclaim the power with humility, as we said. So let's just play that out a bit, right? So for example, in that story, Lauren learned that she could be firm with the mother-in-law while still behaving respectfully. You see, I've said this many times, and it's such an important thing. In relationships, boundaries are very important, but people find it so hard to set boundaries. Why? Because they don't want to hurt the other person. Or they're worried the other person won't be happy with those boundaries. And here's where it comes to exactly what we're talking about. And I've seen this play out so many times just by talking to people. So we have often relationships where one person is being controlled by the other, right? As we've described. But they have a value. They don't want to be disrespectful. They don't want to set boundaries. They don't want the other person to be happy. They're being defined and controlled by the other person, and the value is coming straight from a weakness. And sometimes what people do is that the only way that they cope is by escaping. So they terminate the relationship. And in some instances, and I've said this many times, but it's so important, in some instances, terminating the relationship is the wrong thing to do. It's morally the wrong thing to do. Having the relationship the way you have it now is the wrong thing to do too. Because you're being controlled, you're being undermined, you're being undervalued, and you're being disrespected. So part of living life with values that come from strength is knowing how to implement those values and not being so worried about how it's going to be received. So I've told many people, for example, I've had this conversation with many people who have, for example, elderly relatives that want them to visit them, but they always say it's not enough. And therefore, they're just going crazy because it's never enough. So the answer is you need to choose what is the right thing to do. It doesn't matter if it's enough or not, but you need to do it because it's the right thing to do. And you need to maintain that relationship in most cases, especially when it talks about parents and parents-in-law and children and things like that, which are close family relationships. You need to continue that or at least never be disrespectful. Some relationships have to be terminated, of course. But even then, they can be terminated in a respectful way, and they can be terminated in a way where we terminate the relationship maybe, but we don't continue to go out of our way to be disrespectful or humiliating to the other person, because humiliating another person is not correct. So learning to set boundaries means that I still live by, I reclaim my power and I still are committed to my values. In this case, being respectful to a mother-in-law. But I'm able now to live it from a strength, to set a boundary very respectfully, to still go out of my way, to be respectful. But nevertheless, even though I know that maybe initially, particularly those boundaries are not well received, but I know it's the right thing to do in context of all my other values, and therefore I'm able to do it, that's the benefit of reclaiming the power. So not to be, and as I said before, sometimes what people do is they escape. The other thing people do is they flip and they become hostile and disrespectful. Disrespect is a bad value. Disrespect is never a good thing. So it's all about the effects of not having the power over your own values, not having the power of your own choices in a selfless way, but not having the power necessarily. And therefore, you either feel controlled or you explode and you become disrespectful and aggressive. Disrespect, aggression, all these things, total rejection, all these things are bad things. But if you reclaim the power, you're able to then decide rationally, properly, the choices that need to be made, the boundaries that need to be set, and do it in a proper way, in a respectful way. The other amazing benefit of reclaiming the power of our own choices in a humble way, in a selfless way, is the ability to let go. And where that expresses itself so strongly is in the art of forgiveness. Now we did a whole series of forgiveness, but briefly, the concept of forgiveness, as we know, it doesn't mean agreeing with the other person and doesn't mean condoning the other person's legitimately bad behavior, right? In other words, when we say, even if it's really bad behavior, but it means letting go of resentment. And what it means is exactly this point of not letting other people control us. I'll just tell you a little story that she tells in the book, because she talks about this a little bit in about forgiveness. She talks about someone who was a police officer. His name is Stephen McDonald. And he was working as an officer in 1986 in New York. And he stopped to question some teenagers about their recent bicycle thefts. One of those 15-year-olds in question took out a gun and shot him. And injured him. And paralyzed him. Now, miraculously, this officer survived. He spent 18 months in hospital recuperating and learning how to live as a quadriplegic. And at the time of the accident, he'd only been married, I mean, it's an extreme example, this. He'd only been married 88 months and his wife was 6 months pregnant. Now, before I continue the story, it's an extreme story, but sometimes we bring out a point, as I've said many times, we bring out a point by extreme examples. So he says, remarkably, Officer McDonald and his wife chose not to focus on all that had been taken away from them by the teenage boy. Instead, they made a conscious choice to forgive him. In fact, a few years later, after his injury, the officer's assailant called him from jail to apologize. Officer McDonald not only accepted his apology, but also told him that he hoped someday they could travel the country together, sharing their story with the hope they could prevent others from acts of violence. Officer McDonald never got a chance to do that, however, because 3 days after his assailant was released from prison, the young man was killed in a motorcycle accident. And he said, this is a line that he said, listen to this, he said, "The only thing worse than a bullet in my spine would have been to nurture revenge in my heart." He says this in his book, which he wrote, called Why Forgive, which I haven't read. That's an amazing line. In other words, this is a person, obviously, who's a police officer. His job was to enforce the law. He would obviously never condone violence. He would do everything to protect himself, others, and to prosecute the law. To put people in jail if they're violent. But he never let that person who injured him in the most terrible way and ruined his life, he never let him control him. He let go. He let go of the resentment. Didn't agree with him, of course not. He would put other people in jail for the same crime. But he didn't let him control him. He wasn't controlled by that person. That's an amazing accomplishment. But part of reclaiming control, power over ourselves, is the ability to let go and eventually the ability to actually forgive. Now, from a Jewish perspective, and again, we've talked about this before, and it's a hard thing to implement, but nevertheless true. I want to just add this in because it's so amazingly in line with the Jewish way of thinking. Because the Jewish way of thinking, and this is, I'm just going to quote you something from a great author which we've quoted many times called the Sefer HaChinuch. He was a great author. He lived in I don't know, 12th, 13th, 14th century, and wrote an explanation of each one of the 613 mitzvot of the Torah. And what he does is he gives a little philosophical explanation of each one. And he comments on the law in the Torah not to take revenge and not even to bear a grudge, right? So we know this is actually mandated in the Torah. The Torah asks us not to take revenge, but not only not to take revenge, but not to carry around hate in our heart, not to bear a grudge. And it's a very difficult thing to do, especially when someone has done something really wrong to us, right? And he says that one of the foundations behind this mitzvah is the concept of remembering that everything that happens to us in life, good or bad, and I always say this, we don't want bad, we don't pray for bad, we ask God not to give us bad, but ultimately everything that happens to us comes from God and not from people. Hashkacha pratit, in other words, everything that happens to us comes from God. As the Chovat HaLevavot, also a great master of ethics who talks about faith and trust in God, makes the point that no one can ever ruin your chances for success. No one. No one has, at the end of the day, no one has control over us. So this is a very hard concept to swallow. What happens, for example, in the case of that police officer, someone injures you? Of course they've ruined you. What happens if someone is about to start a business and someone says something really not nice about him? And as a result, he loses the business deal. I'll share with you a little personal story. And again, I only share with you the stories that worked, right? As I always tell you. It's one of my children. I won't go into any level of detail because it's not appropriate. But with one of my children, a shidduch didn't work out, right? The system that we work with is the shidduch dating system where we suggest certain marriages and so on. A certain shidduch didn't work out, and we found out later the reason was because someone said something not nice about her, about one of my children. Initially, I was really, really upset, and then my wife and I discussed this, and we reminded ourselves about this concept. Now, I don't say I'm always successful at doing this, so again, I always only tell you the stories that worked. And we remember those words of the Chovat HaLevavot that said that no one can stand in the way of something that is meant to happen for you. So therefore, if it didn't happen, it wasn't meant to happen, and maybe on the contrary, maybe God was protecting me and her from it happening. And the end of the story is, of course, good. That child found a beautiful shidduch and is happily married, thank God. Right? But so it's a very, very powerful thing, but it comes fundamentally from learning that no one else can control us. Only we can control ourselves, and from a Jewish perspective, the more we learn about the concept of Hashgacha Pratit, and the more we learn that it's not other people that, if other people ruin us, we have to take measures. We have to have control to set boundaries, to protect ourselves, to turn them into the police, to protect society if it's that bad. That's because that's part of moral living. And God wants us to make moral choices that we've talked about many times. But in terms of letting the person control me, that I should bear hate, I should walk around with resentment, that person has ruined my chances or stood in the way of my success. If we really believe, from a Jewish perspective, if we really understand the words of the Sefer HaChinuch, we really understand the words of the Chovat HaLevavot, that no one could really ruin our chance. If it's meant to happen, it's going to happen. If it's not meant to happen, it won't happen. That's the perfect perspective to use when we take back control over ourselves, we understand our own self-worth, that we are in control of our own choices, our own value choices, and our own responses. We have the power. We need to live a life based on values that we choose to live by, from a strength, not from a weakness, not from being controlled by others. Of course, we know the classic example that I always use from the Torah story of Yosef, Joseph, that Joseph refused to let himself be resentful of his brothers, even though they, on the surface, ruined his life for 20 years. He landed up in Egypt, isolated from his family, and yet he said, God sent me here. And I know why, because he sent me to be able to sustain you and give you food and be able to be a source of sustenance. Sometimes we find out the reason, sometimes not. But that's an amazing thing. know, recently I watched a couple of YouTube videos just because it was an interesting topic about the Project Innocence in America. And it's an amazing thing about people who were put in jail for like 20, 25 years for crimes they didn't commit, clearly didn't commit. And I'm always in awe. I'm always amazingly inspired by some of those people that come out and they're interviewed and they say they don't carry around heart. They don't carry around hate. And one of them said, he says, what good will it be for me to walk around with hate? I've lost 20 years already. Why should I lose any more years? I need to move forward. I need to reclaim myself. I need to move on. Now, this should never happen. And some of these people have thrown themselves into campaigns and projects to avoid people being incarcerated when they didn't do the crime. Yes, that's true. Prevent it happening in the future, but they have control over their own values and therefore are able to forgive. You can only forgive if you let go. You can only let go if you have control over yourself, if you reclaim your own power. In the book, she talks about one of the ways to reach this also is to watch our own language. Things like, you know, people say, come back from work and say, my boss makes me so angry. That language is bad language. It means he's controlling me. He makes me. You know, he doesn't make you angry. You make yourself angry. Now, he might be doing terrible. He might be doing things that are inappropriate, for which you need to make a choice. Either you learn to live with it or you find a different job. That's true. But wallowing in he makes me angry means I'm in his control and things like that. The other thing, of course, is when we learn to have control over ourselves, I just want to go back to this point before we finish, is we learn also how to use the benefit of criticism. Now, we've talked about this in the past, but when I control my responses, when I have power, when I don't give power to you or to anyone else, I give power to myself, then I choose the way I respond. And then, when someone criticizes me, I break it down. I'll just break it down the way she does in the book. She says, I learn to ask myself some questions. Like, what evidence is, if you criticize me, I need to stop, have power over myself, choose my own responses. I choose the pathway that I'm going to respond to this criticism. I'm not going to let you make me angry or hurt or offended, but I'm going to choose my response by asking the question, what evidence is there that this is true? Or, and I'm going to try to be honest about it to myself, or I'm going to say, what evidence do I have that it isn't true? Maybe it is true to some degree. What might this person be giving me this feedback? Why? Why are they giving me this feedback? And maybe there's something I do need to change. Part of what he's saying is true. Part of what he's saying, I'm just going to dismiss because it was untrue. It wasn't accurate. All of that can only be done when we reclaim power. So, she also cites an amazing, I'll share with you an amazing thing about forgiveness. Learning to forgive by taking back power is an amazing thing. And research, there's apparently research now that forgiveness reduces stress. And that choosing to forgive increases tolerance of pain. It's a 2005 study. And unconditional forgiveness actually brings longevity. So if you're looking for some benefits, there they are. So we've run out of time, but the point is very simple. The point is, to summarize, that we should live by values, value-based living, which we've talked about many times. But we should learn to live by those values from a strength. Again, not from a selfishness, not from egocentricity, not only if I understand or talks to me, but by the choice of being selfless, the choice. And that includes sometimes letting someone say something bad to me if it's not over the top and letting it go. We talked about this last week. Ha'ma'avir al midotav, that the Talmud says that someone who can not fire back when they're offended is an amazing thing. We learn to give. We learn to be selfless. We learn to also be strong. We learn to protect ourselves when necessary. We learn to create boundaries. But we learn to do all of that from a strength. And then we're able to choose the ethical and moral way of implementing our values, which means we're able to balance them, we're able to continue them, we're able to maintain them, and we're able to do that because we take away power from everyone else over us and rather give the power to ourselves for self-control and choice of living by those values. So we'll do the other chapter hopefully next week and some of the other chapters. In the meantime, everyone should have a wonderful day and Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks, you're very Rabbi. Welcome. Thank all the best. All the best.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Too much love.